You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Okay. Hi, I'm Chris Walken. Leonard Lopate took the day off, and I'm filling in for him. My first guest is Jack O'Brien. He's won 3 Tony Awards, directing plays so different. Hairspray, Henry IV, Tom Stoppard's trilogy, Coast of Utopia. And joining us today with Jack is Richard Easton, my old pal, all of us old friends. Richard played in Jack's production of Tom Stoppard's The Coast of Utopia. He was the recipient of the 2001 Tony Award for Best Actor for his performance in another Stoppard play, The Invention of Love, and Hamlet, and Noises Off, and Henry IV, and stuff that goes way back with me. I'd like to start talking about how we met in 1969.
That's it.
Mm-hmm. The San Diego...
Hardly a man is now alive, as they say.
The Globe Festival, we did Shakespeare. And Jack, I didn't realize that the Comedy of Errors, which you directed,
that's right,
was also your last performance on stage.
With the exception of 1 week of Love Letters that I did with Michael Learned years later. But you were playing Antipholus,
yes.
And an actor named Jimmy Whittle was playing the Dromio, and on the opening night, as I recall, he had hurt himself in Richard's stunning production, Julius Caesar, nearly failed many people, I'm told.
Me too.
And you were very good in that.
And there was no one to play opposite you as your Dromio, and I went on and played, I think, 10 performances, and it was a life-altering experience, Chris, because we were pretty darn good. And I used to give, you probably don't remember this, I used to give an apology to begin with, saying to the ladies and gentlemen, I'm terribly sorry, the actor supposed to play this part is not available and you're stuck with me. And then I would go on with you to give a dazzling comedy turn.
Exactly.
And Seda Thompson, who was in that production, there was a storytelling opening where everybody was listening to the old guy tell the story of what happened. And Seda and I were up on the inner above. And one night she crept over, little by little. I could see her out of my peripheral vision and crept over. And I felt her knee in my back as I was sitting down. And I looked up and she said, "Don't you think it's time to stop the apology? We're looking pretty stupid up here." But that was the experience where I realized in the middle of a big laugh, huge laugh, it was a funny play. It's a very funny play.
Very funny.
And there was a sequence where if you did it, then the line right, you got around. You got an applause. And I remember while the applause was happening, my thinking, this is what every actor dreams of, and I am miserable. And I never acted again.
Well,
and you were responsible.
But you became a wonderful director. And I've often thought, you know, people ask actors, would you like to direct? And a lot of actors say yes.
I know.
But not me. No. I always say absolutely not. I wouldn't.
I don't think there's another profession like this one in which almost everybody thinks they can do it.
Yeah. When I look at what a director does and even if – you know, if somebody came up to me and said, you know, whether it was costumes or the cameraman or whatever, what do you think we should do? I'd say, you know, do whatever you want.
Ask exactly. Somebody. Yeah.
But that's not a good way to do it. And Richard, that same summer, you directed.
Yes, that killed me for directing, too. And that was also to do with you, in fact. Because I had imagined that I think it was sort of like Tiepolo or somebody. We had no money, of course. So the costumes I invented, this sort of form-fitting armor that they wore in all those paintings, the Renaissance paintings. And we had to do it with sort of jersey T-shirts, basically, in various colors. And you, because you were our hero, Mark Antony, had to be yellow. And so you were stuck with this yellow T-shirt that you had to wear. And I was wearing blue because I wore whatever. And everybody was fine. And you suddenly were rather unhappy, and you kept saying, "I look like a canary."
That's right.
"What am I doing?" And I was saying, "No,
Tweety
no, it's lovely. It's absolutely wonderful.
Tweety
and I wouldn't have it."
Bird.
But that persuaded yes, exactly. But it persuaded me that I weren't a director.
But we were kids together, weren't we? We were all just kids, all of us.
Well, yes.
So much fun.
We had such fun.
Oh, it was so great. Great. wonderful time. Playing. But I suppose that you it helps, I think, to be a director who's been an actor.
Maybe. I mean, I think it certainly helps. Yes, I think that's true. As long as you
but
don't...
But only once, really, basically, an actor.
Yes.
I mean, because all the greatest directors are not actors.
Anymore.
Peter Brook was never an actor. Tony Guthrie, never an actor. You know.
But the great thing about...
Jack.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the inclusion.
You're well included in that.
But you know, Mike Nichols is a terrific actor.
Oh, God.
I think it must help, you know, anyway, just with the rehearsal process, because...
Well, you sort of know what it feels
exactly.
like.
Exactly. And I've worked with very good directors who really don't know anything about rehearsing.
Right.
And I think that if you're an actor, it helps.
Yes.
I don't think there's any question.
But actors know about rehearsing, so we can do that. And the directors can cope with the sets and the clothes and the timings and all that stuff that's of no interest to us.
Yeah.
No, it's of no interest to us either, but we...
But you pretend that we're
stuck with it, you see, because you guys won't do it.
That's what you get paid for.
That's right.
Jack, you had 4 plays running at the same time in New York. Hairspray, The Coast of Utopia, 1 and 2. How the Grinch Stole Christmas and Dirty Rotten Scoundrels was touring.
Yeah.
All over the place. And,
yeah. It's weird, isn't it? Because you see...
But this transition from a movie to the stage, in the old days, it used to be the other way around, I guess.
I know.
You take a play and it would become a musical. And right now you're doing Catch Me If You Can. I'm familiar with that show.
Right, I know you are. We had a hell of a time following your act, I'll tell you.
Are you into that now?
We go in rehearsal in January. Oh, we're casting right now.
And you're working with
the same team that did Hairspray, basically.
Yeah. And I know those guys. I like them very much.
Yeah, they're great score. But, you know, it's interesting because the economics are such that producers trying to raise money for a show want to know that the story is solid. And so you say, well, I like that damn movie. I bet this will make a great musical.
Right.
And sometimes it does. But my theory is there has to be some element of performance in the screenplay itself that would justify you singing. Or, I mean, every movie isn't going to make... You know, Deer Hunter is not going to make a great musical, in spite of my admiration.
No, but Theater of Blood might.
Yes, it might.
Exactly.
But,
for that reason.
Like Dirty Rotten Scoundrels was of these two guys showing off for each other. Hairspray's a little fat girl who wants to be a dancer on television. If you have built into it some idea that would say, okay, sing, kid, then maybe you got a shot at it. But everybody, every screenplay ain't going to do it. That's all there is to it.
I'm thinking back to San Diego, and I remember that we did matinees. And I remember one matinee in 1969. I can't remember whether it was Julius Caesar or Comedy of Errors. And all the actors would run off stage to the green room to watch the men land on the moon.
Oh, yeah,
yes.
I know.
Yes.
Yeah.
Some things are more important than others, really, I guess.
That's a while ago.
I understand the audience is running out to do the same thing.
No, those shows were actually very good.
They were good.
And some of the best times I've had.
It was wonderful. And I remember we were all, us Easterners were also amazed that nobody ever walked anywhere in San Diego.
Right.
And we were in the park. And so we would go, after rehearsal, we would all be sort of wandering across the bridge. And before you'd gone 100 yards, there'd be a police car right next to it saying, who are you? What are you doing? Where are you going?
I didn't want to bring that up, but
no,
you're right.
It was extraordinary.
I used to get searched.
Well, but you would be.
They thought I was a cat.
But you were blonde. Yes.
Yes.
Blondes only get
My
searched.
Hair was too long.
Yeah, they were
but
suspicious.
It was amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. Because people didn't walk on foot.
No.
But the Mexican food was great.
Oh, man.
Oh, yes.
Oh, man.
And the whole thing was in staying in rooming houses and all that. It was just divine. It was wonderful.
Yeah.
Something sort of innocent about
making
it.
Art.
And Jack, you became the artistic director of the Old Globe
forever.
Yeah, for a long time.
Yeah.
At the time, it was a terrific man named Craig Knoll.
And he just died in '93,
and you took over.
Well, yeah, but the interesting thing is, this is kind of fascinating because he was such a great mentor to me, and and a great editor. But when I took over, because he'd grown up there and he established that thing, he didn't go away. I kept him there. And it's the only time I ever remember, maybe not only in the arts, but maybe in business, where a CEO invites somebody to take over the organization and then doesn't leave.
Yeah.
And we never had a crossword. We never had any confusion. I mean, he was such a – he taught me so many lessons, but patience was one of them, you know.
And after I was there, they built another theater.
Yeah.
When I was there, it was just the Globe.
That's right. Well, also, don't forget, you were in the original Globe, and then in 1978, there was an arson. And
oh, right. It burned down.
Famously yeah. burned down. And then while that was going on, in 40 days, we put up an outside theater that was so successful, it's still there. So now there are three theaters there, which is great.
Who runs it now?
A guy by the name of Lou Spisto, and your old director from the RSC was there this,
yes.
this summer, Hall.
Adrian Hall.
Adrian Hall. Had yes. a huge, huge success.
Yes.
And so he's come over from England over the summer, and I think that's great because that sustains that real classical yeah. Sort of tradition out there that that we've always
I loved
so
him. Proud. He was very good at the RSC when I was there. He did Branagh's Henry V.
Right.
Which he rather copied in the film.
Well, why not?
Why not indeed?
Yeah. It was pretty good. But you know, yeah, I was there for 27 years, Chris, running that place.
Good spot.
It was a great spot.
Yeah.
And it sort of, the reason, I mean, people keep saying, you know, what is this stuff about you doing musicals and Shakespeare and all this sort of stuff? And I said, well, you know, you run a theater for 25 years and you'll know how to do all that stuff too, because it always falls to the artistic director if something goes wrong to pick up the pieces and do it. And it was a great training, amazing training ground for me that really prepared me for everything that's gone on since.
Yeah.
It's really great. I mean, that kind of experience. People are so eager to get into New York and do it. And I keep saying, they shouldn't see too much of your work. I mean, they shouldn't. I mean, it's got to be sort of an event, I think.
It's true. For an actor, you know, the idea of being able to go someplace and work things out.
And make mistakes.
Make lots of mistakes. And absolutely. I was going to ask you about taking a film and doing it into a musical, which you've done now a number of times.
Yes, I have.
And it seems to me is a particular thing that I can't think of anybody else who does it the way you do. To take a film like, Hairspray was originally a film.
But not a musical, right.
Was it called Hairspray?
Yeah.
The John
sure.
Waters?
Yeah, absolutely.
And Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, The Grinch Who Stole Christmas, and now with Catch Me If You Can.
Right.
How do you do that?
Well, I mean, you got to be lucky. You got to have great partners. I mean, you know, nobody does this by themselves. You know that. And there's no art form in maybe all of the performing arts as collaborative as doing a musical, because you've got a composer and a lyricist, you've got a librettist, you've got, you know, a choreographer and then all of their associates and assistants. You've got a series of designers and everyone is trying to make some story make sense. And so what you have to do is make it incredibly clear that you're all on the same page and then yet still accommodate everybody, allow everybody their voice. You can't be a martinet. You can if it's just the three of us. I mean, the two of you and doing a play and the director and maybe a dead author, you're okay, you know. But when you have to get, what if it is 17, 25 people into a room and give notes and listen to everybody, it's a very, very delicate operation, no question about it. And it's so interesting, Chris, because one of the things I've learned over the years is never listen to the music if somebody offers you a show.
Oh, yeah? I was just going to ask you, is the music come first?
Or? No, I mean, whatever the music does, I learned to my detriment that you hear a beautiful song and you think, God, I'd love to see that on the stage. And then you think, this book is sort of not too good, but I'll make it pretty. You know? I can move that around. Yeah. You can't. And you have to dry it out. And if the book works, and I keep saying to people who are doing librettos or writing the books, I mean, bless their hearts, they're one stage above plankton on the food chain. You know, everybody attacks the book, and everybody says it's the fault. But it is. And if that story is solid, then your music can drape it and do wonderful things with it. But if that, and I've learned because I got seduced by, you know, great music or a funny song or something, you think, I'd really love to do that.
Uh-huh.
But if the book isn't there, you are dead in the water and yeah. nothing will help.
Because I'd have figured that the music was the first thing you thought about, you know.
Well, somebody thinks about it, yeah.
But I mean, to have good music, certainly.
Yeah, you got to have a good score. But if you have a great score and a rotten story, it's not going to sing. It's not going to go. If you've got an okay score and a great story, they'll sit still for it in an odd way. It's very interesting. The glamorous part is the music, no question about it. And that's why everybody wants to do it, and that's why you go. But the truth of the matter is, it's that underpinning. And if that story isn't there and you can't buy it, there's nothing you can do.
Hmm. They're telling me I have to go to a break. I'll just say this, and then we'll come back. I'm speaking with Jack O'Brien, Tony Award-winning director, and we're going to take a break. I'm with Richard Easton, Tony Award-winning actor. I was just up for a Tony. I lost.
Yes, you did. Not with my vote.
You know,
you didn't.
It's awful to go and lose. And later on the show, I'll speak with my former co-star, Zoe Kazan, about her acting career. Plus, I'll catch up with my childhood friends, Lydia Bastianich, and her mom, Aminia Motika. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. Where's my reintroduce? Do I say something? Oh, okay. Okay. Hi, I'm Chris Walken. I'm here with Jack O'Brien and Richard Easton, my old pals from the old days. I wanted to ask you both something. I mean, you both, Jack was an actor, he became a director, and Richard does all these plays, and how is it to have, when you work, do you like to have the writer there?
You, Richard, you got to go there.
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes, particularly if it's Tom Stoppard, because he's so funny.
I was going to ask you about that.
Please. But it was wonderful, because when we did, all of them, but when we did The Invention of Love, and he was sitting there in rehearsal and all that, and then suddenly he said, what? What was that? I don't know. Can I see the script? Well, that's not right. No. Has anybody got an old script of the last time we did it? Oh, they're here. Now, this is much better. put this in. And all that. And no, I've always found them wonderful. I very seldom work with living playwrights. But when I do, it's marvelous. Can you say, I don't get this. This takes me to a different place from where the play seems to want me to be. And generally speaking, they say, oh, yeah, all right, well, say this instead or whatever.
I have trouble with other people's punctuation.
And I've noticed.
And so sometimes it's intimidating because the writer takes punctuation sometimes quite seriously.
Yes.
I've even had said, there's a pause there. Would you please take it? I wondered about Jack when you're directing, if you have the writer there. Is it ever intimidating, especially if it's, you know, somebody like
Shakespeare? Yes.
Well, but that's what I was thinking about.
He's not often there,
Shakespeare, but he's and Chekhov and all those people.
Yes. They're pretty quiet these days.
They're pretty quiet. But it can be, for an actor, for me anyway, it can be to have him sitting there knowing that he's watching your every move.
Well, I mean, first of all, I love the plays. I mean, and so. By a process, whether it's Shakespeare or Chekhov or Stoppard or anybody, or the librettists in the musicals, I love that they've done this
and the input.
And I don't want to do that myself. I want them to be happy. I'm there basically to serve the play. I'm not there to show off. I'm there to somehow intercede between the script and you, so that I think that that's honest what you're doing. And I think it's funny, or I think it's moving, but it seems right. do you? You say to the writer, and stop art. The first show I did with him, which was, and I was, I mean, now we're really close, and I can't believe we're friends, but we are. And the first one was Hapgood, this very, very abstruse, very complicated thing I did at Lincoln Center years ago for Stocker Channing. And, you know, it's about quantum physics, and it's about twinning, and it's, you know, Tom's plays are never about one thing. They're about 11, you know. So I had not really, he'd gone back to England. We'd done some work, and he'd gone back to England, and he came back to, for the rest of the rehearsal. And I'd done a scene with Joe Summer and a few people, and it was the end of the first act. And I was just terrified because I thought, you know, what's he going to think of this? And I kind of liked what we did. I think we all thought, well, yeah, this is what it's about. And so we did the scene, and I turned to him, and I said, Tom, what do you think? And he said, well, other than the fact that the wrong people are on the stage, I think it's probably fine.
Now, honestly, but I was going to mention casting.
Now, wait a minute.
A director.
I mean, I have told him the story, and he blanches visibly. He cannot believe he said that. And he did. We were all, you could hear the intake of breath from everybody in the room, you know. And finally, he explained things that we didn't know. And he was absolutely right. And he spoon-fed that whole, I mean, me and quantum physics, get a grip. I mean, that's going to happen, right? But he explained it to me without condescending to me. In the most wonderful way, and so together we made it work. But I mean, if you've got Tom Stoppard in the rehearsal hall,
yeah,
don't you want to hear from him? I think you do.
Absolutely.
I mean,
did he change things, or
yes,
you know, see something's should be some other way? And
absolutely,
say, yeah,
absolutely, mm-hmm. And very helpful, and also equally generous and surprising. I mean, the very famous story between the two of us is that when I did Coast of Utopia, each of the three parts of the trilogy began the same, with Brian O'Byrne spinning in a chair and this mound of moving silk looking like water, and suddenly it would rip away. And with each different play, there was something different under the water. There was everything. I tried to couch it as if it was a dream that the character was having. And so we do the first one, and it's we're stunned, but it's a big success, you know, because it's so scary. Now we're doing the second one in Tex, and where Tom is sitting next to me, and the music starts, and there's Brian in the chair, and the silk is going, and Tom leans over and he says, are you doing this again? And I said, Tom, I'm doing it for all three of them. Oh, he said, okay, I just wanted to know. He had no vision that's was going to be. So it's a mutual thing that, you know, you dance and I dance, and suddenly we work it out together. And so having that mind, in listening for the text, for what the text means, you know, the punctuation, a really great actor, and forgive me, I'm not blowing a little smoke here, you're right there. I mean, I've seen you bend all those lines and do all that stuff. But it's like a great singer. You're into something so musical and so ineffably right for you that you can afford to do that. A less experienced actor, a less gifted actor, you want them to stay on board with this punctuation so they know where to breathe. But that's not a problem for you. And so we surprise each other that way. And that's bliss when that happens.
Oh, absolutely. A lot of rehearsal, I think, is serendipity. You know, people says to me, you know, what are you looking for? I always say some sort of accident, a great accident that you can repeat.
Yeah, absolutely.
Also, with Stoppard, there are many productions of the plays. I mean, it's done in San Francisco, it's done in Washington, then it's done on Broadway. So he's used to the idea that his original thing is the kind of germ that is sent out there. But everybody who grabs it is going to come out with something different.
Sure.
With it. And he's used to that idea, and he finds it organic and interesting to him, and it is organic and correct, I think.
Also, I have to say in my case, that with the exception of Hapgood, but both Invention of Love and Coast of Utopia, I went to school on the productions. I mean, Richard Eyre did Invention of Love, and Trevor Nunn did The Coast.
Yeah.
And I saw both of those productions, and there was much to admire in them, but there was also a great deal to learn when you think to yourself, well, yeah, but that's not what I want to do.
Yeah.
And there's
and
nothing.
And he likes that. And that's good for an
actor. And it's also like seeing...
It's not as if, this is how you do that. This is what I wrote, and this is what must happen.
Exactly.
That's not happy when you encounter that, which you do, of course.
I a long time ago, did Sweet Bird of Youth, and Tennessee Williams was around a lot for the rehearsals.
Irene Wuerth. Wow.
And he was very charming. And I remember once saying to him in rehearsal, and it was toward the end of the play, I said, when I'm talking about this, I don't really know what I'm talking about. And he said, change it, honey. He said, just fix it. He said, say whatever you think makes sense. And I never had a writer say that to me.
Did you?
No, of course not. I'm not sure that he meant it. But that's what he said to me, and I never did that again. But, subsequently I found out that he had written, I think, 6 versions of that scene.
Oh, yeah.
And
Kazan used to beat him over the head to rewrite stuff and do it differently, too, don't forget.
Change it, fix it.
Exactly.
Wonderful.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
I think Ned Roram, one of my favorite quotes of all time, composer Ned Roram has written, history is never fantastic while it's being lived. And sure. I think that's such a cool thing to think about because, all of these little moments of our own history and our own interactions with various extraordinary people. Yeah. And at the time, you're just doing what you do. You don't think, wow, this is fancy. This is really great. You just think, I hope I can get through the day.
Yeah. And Jack, you've directed opera.
I have.
Have you done any opera, Richard?
I've done musicals, but never an actual opera.
There's a part in Mozart's Abduction for the Seraglio for an actor.
Yes.
The Pasha. And a long time ago, somebody said, would you come to Omaha? They have a fabulous opera house there.
Yeah.
And the soprano was Catherine Molfitano.
Oh, I know Kathy, right.
And I went there. I had no idea what I was doing. And I had a speaking part in this opera. And it was just unbelievable being on stage.
With those voices.
With those voices
and the orchestra. And really very unique for an actor to be able to do that. When you direct opera, is there any kind of difference?
Yeah, there is. I think there is. I mean, first of all, because I don't pretend to be an opera director. I'm not a regisseur. That's not my tradition. And even though my first big break in theater, which was the Porgy and Bess in the late 70s that really established my career, and then... For like 10 years, Kathy Malfitano did a street scene for me at City Opera. And, I had like 10 years when I was doing a lot of opera, of Tosca and Santa Fe and Magic Flute in San Francisco and stuff. So, and I am a bit of a musician. I play piano and, I read music badly, but I do have a musical background. And so, but I don't understand the ethos. I just think you got to be real in the scenes. And I had a great experience just a year ago or a year and a half ago, and I did the Puccini Tritico at the Metropolitan Opera. I'd never worked at the Met. And that's Puccini's 3-1 acts, and they're each of them very different. And I just threw myself into them as if they were pure, unadulterated. Well, this is the thing. I've always talked to singers as if they're actors, and I talk to actors as if they're musicians. Then I don't get in your way. If I am not using the vocabulary that you need to keep your performance your own, but if I can express it in some other metaphor so that you can hear it differently, we can talk to each other without my fingerprinting your choices. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Yes, and it works.
In opera, I would think that in when you're doing a play, It's always different, but very often the blocking is a little bit loose.
Yeah.
Certainly at the beginning, even if the director knows exactly what he wants, it's kind of a little mushy in the beginning, which I think is good. But in opera, I would think you'd have to be quite specific about you go over here now and you know.
Well, first of all, they've got to be able to see the composer or the conductor.
Yes.
They've got to be able to, you've got to have them where they can effortlessly look, cheat, and still honor the dramatic situation. But also there are other things, like sometimes when you get a grouping of singers on stage, they have to be in some proximity, tenors and, let's say, altos, or tenors and baritones, so they can get
the separation of sound.
Yeah, and I remember also in this in the old State Theater when I did Street Scene, they told me there was a place way down right that if you stood down right, it just pinged the music around the house. So I loved knowing that because I put the tenor singing Lonely House down there, you know, in a really groovy kind of, you know, obscure, weird deal. And he was just nailing it. And you thought, isn't that interesting that the house can help you or defeat you in that way?
Sure. That's so interesting that you say that. I read books about actors from all different times. And in the 19th century, when stage acting was, you know, the thing that actors were known by, that all the great actors knew exactly the spot.
Yes.
On every
sweet
stage.
Spot. Yeah.
All over the country, all over the world, you didn't know exactly where to go.
But you see, I contend that no matter where you're acting, that's true. That proximity, being there, it's never center stage, by the way.
Right.
It's never center stage. That's the last place you want to go, and particularly in Mozart. That's the last, because everybody goes right to sleep when you go to center stage. But if a director doesn't know that, doesn't understand how to get you there, or doesn't have a feel for what that physically feels like. I mean, I always get on the stage before the actors do when the set is there and start moving around because you can feel it. It's like a driving seat.
It's a power place.
It is. Yeah. It is. Yeah. And it's very different depending on what the designer does and what the house does. And, you know, it's helpful to have some knowledge because a really good actor, you put him over there and you can just see their shoulders drop and think, yeah, let me at it, you know. It's great.
Well, musical theater, I mean, whether it's opera or musicals, I mean, if somebody says, let's go see a show, I'll always say, let make it a musical. But there is that Elizabethan and maybe even way before that, the Greeks, that hangover of making the audience another character in the play.
Yes. That's the point, is that it involves the audience. Yeah. Whereas so much acting, and particularly now, is removing the audience. It's a separate.
That fourth wall idea is not a good idea,
it's
really.
Ridiculous, yes. Yeah. And it means that they're sort of private, little private behavior here. And if you're lucky, you'll see it.
Including the audience is great.
Yes.
Well, musicals do that.
I also remember with Shakespeare, that's really interesting. Sure. The soliloquies. You know, I always thought of them as, because my mentor, Ellis Rabb, always felt that they were spoken thought, that the soliloquies were an opportunity, which indeed they are, for the actor to explore the psyche of what the character's feeling. But when I went up to Stratford and saw the shows up there, their style basically is to throw it straight into the house. And so that it's you and me, if it's Iago or somebody like that, they're talking straight to the audience on these soliloquies. And they work equally well either way, but it is a choice that the actor and the director have to be comfortable with, I think.
Well, Chekhov too, really.
Yeah.
They're telling me to...
I don't blame them.
They're telling me to go to another break. I've been speaking with director Jack O'Brien and Richard Easton, and thanks so much for being with me today, Jack and Richard. Up next, Zoe Kazan. I hope you were able to see her with me on Broadway recently. She'll fill us in on Angels in America. This is WNYC and WNYC.org, and we're also available as a podcast.